room and change her from her dark blue gown to one of pale green, a good colour for spring. As her maid holds the dress out for her to step into, I can see that she has a rounded belly where she was once so spare, and her breasts fill the fine linen shift. I smile at the sight of her. We wait for the king to come bursting in, his face alight with joy, his hands held out to her. We wait for an hour. We hear the watchman giving the time, and then finally we hear the footsteps outside, and the guards throw open the doors to the queen's apartment. We all rise to our feet, expecting to see the king rush in, his boyish face beaming. But it is Richard Tunstall again, the king's chamberlain, with a reply to the queen's message.
His grace bid me tell you this, that the news is to our most singular consolation, and to all true liege people's great joy and comfort, he says.
He gulps and looks at me. Is that all? I ask. He nods. The queen looks blankly at him. Is he coming to me?
I don't think so, Your Grace. He clears his throat. He was so happy that he rewarded me for bringing the news, he volunteers.
Is he coming to visit Her Grace before dinner?
He has called his jeweller to see him. He is having a special jewel made for the Queen, he says.
But what is he doing now? She asks. Right now, as you left him. Richard Tunstall gives another bow.
He has gone to give thanks in his private chapel, he says. The king has gone to pray.
Good, she says dismally. Oh, good. We don't see the king until that evening, when he comes to visit the queen in her rooms before dinner, as usual. He kisses her hand before us all, and tells her that he is most pleased. I glance round the room and see that all her ladies-in-waiting are looking, like me, bewildered. This is a couple who have conceived their first child, after nearly 8 years of waiting. This child makes their marriage complete and their throne secure. Why do they behave as if they are barely acquainted? Margaret is queenly. She gives no sign of expecting more warmth or enthusiasm from him. She bows her head, and she smiles at her king. I am very happy, she says. I pray that we have a son, and if not, a beautiful daughter and a son the next time.
A blessing either way, he says kindly, and gives her his arm and leads her into dinner, seats her most carefully at his side, and then tenderly chooses for her the very choicest pieces of meat and the softest pieces of bread. On his other side, Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, smiles on them both.
After dinner, she says that she will retire early. The court rises as we withdraw, and when we get to the Queen's rooms, she leaves her ladies, and beckoning me, goes into her bedroom. Take off my headdress, she says. I'm so tired, and it makes my head ache. I untie the ribbons and lay the tall cone to one side. Underneath is the pad that keeps the heavy weight balanced upright on her head. I untie that, too, and then let down her hair. I take up a brush and gently start to free the tightly braided plaits, and she closes her eyes. That's better, she says. Plait it up loosely, Jaquetta, and they can send in a glass of warm ale. I twist the thick red gold hair into a plait, and help her take off her surcoat and gown. She pulls on a linen gown for the night and climbs into the big bed, looking like a little child among the rich hangings and thick covers.
You are bound to feel weary, I say. You can just rest.
Everyone will want you to rest. I wonder what it will be, she says idly. Do you think a boy?
Shall I get the cards? I ask, ready to indulge her. She turns her head away.
No, she says, surprising me. And don't you think about it, Jacquetta.
I laugh. I am bound to think about it. This is your first baby. If it is a boy, he will be the next king of England. I'm honour-bound to think of him, and I would think of him anyway for love of you.
Gently, she puts a finger over her lips to silence me.
Don't think too much, then.
Too much?
Don't think about him with the sight, she says. I want him to bloom like a flower, unobserved.
For a moment, I think that she is afraid of some old horrible hedge witchery, casting the evil eye or ill-wishing.
You cannot think that I would do anything to harm him. Just thinking about him would not harm.
Oh, no, she shakes her golden head. No, dear Jacquetta, I don't think that. It's just that I don't want you to know everything. Not everything. Some things are private.
She blushes and turns her face away from me.
I don't want you to know everything.
I think I understand. Who knows what she had to do to gain the interest of such a cool husband? Who knows how seductive she must have been to get him off his knees and into her bed? Did she have to try sluts' tricks that left her feeling ashamed of herself? Whatever you did to conceive this child, it is worth it, I say stoutly. You had to conceive a child, and if you've made a son, it is all the better. Don't think badly of yourself, Margaret, and I will think of nothing at all. She looks up.
Do you think that nothing would be a sin that gave England an heir?
It was a sin for love, I say, and hurt no one. Then it's forgivable.
I don't need to confess it.
I think of Bishop Ayscough, who told the young king not to bed his wife in the first week for fear that the young couple would experience the sin of lust. You needn't confess anything you did to get this child. It had to be done, and it was an act of love. And men don't understand such things. Priests, the least of all. She gives a little sigh.
All right. And don't you think about it.
I wave my hand like a veil over my face. I won't think. I have not a thought in my head. She laughs. I know you can't stop yourself thinking. I know that. And I know you have the sight sometimes. But don't look for this baby. Promise me you will not look for him. And think of him as a wild flower that grows and is a thing of beauty, but nobody knows how it was planted, nor how it came to be there. He's the son of Marguerite the Daisy, I say. He can be the flower that we rejoice to see in springtime, whose coming means spring.
Yes, she says, a wild flower that comes from who knows where.
Grafton, Northamptonshire, summer, 1453. I keep my word to the Queen, and don't puzzle over this long-delayed conception. And she keeps her word to me, and speaks to Edmund, the Duke of Somerset, and he sends my husband home to me, as I go into confinement at Grafton. I have a boy, and we call him Lionel. My daughter, Elizabeth, a married lady, comes and attends me in my confinement, very serious and very helpful, and I find her hanging over the cradle and cooing to the baby. You will have your own soon, I promise her.
I hope so. He's so perfect. He is so beautiful.
He is,
I say with quiet pride. Another son for the House of Rivers. As soon as I'm strong enough to return to court, I get a message from the Queen asking me to join them on progress. Richard has to return to the garrison of Calais, and it is painfully hard for us to part again. Let me come to Calais, I beg him. I can't bear to be without you. All right, he says. Next month. You can come and bring all the younger children. I can't bear to be without you and them either. He kisses my mouth. He kisses both of my hands. And then he mounts his horse and rides away. Clarendon Palace, Wiltshire, summer 1453. The court itself is merry, travelling around the western counties and seeking out traitors and rabble-rousers. The Duke of Somerset has chosen the route, and says that gradually the people are coming to learn that they cannot speak evil of the king, that there is no future in their demands, and more important than anything else, that Richard, Duke of York, will never be a power in the kingdom, and so allying with him, or calling on his name, is a waste of time. Edmund Beaufort is especially attentive to the king this summer, urging him on to be more and more severe in his judgments and rigorous in his sentencing. He strengthens his mind by applauding his decisions and encourages him to speak out. The Duke accompanies the king to chapel and brings him to the Queen's rooms before dinner, where the three of them sit and talk, and the Duke makes them laugh with his account of the day, sometimes mocking the ignorant people who have been before him. The Queen cannot ride in her condition, and Edmund Beaufort has trained a beautiful set of matched mules to carry her litter. He himself rides beside her, keeping his great horse reined back to the slow speed of the mules, watching her for any sign of fatigue. He consults me almost every day to make sure that I am happy with the Queen's health, with her diet, with her exercise. Every day I assure him that she is well, that her belly is growing as it should, that I am certain that the baby is strong. Almost every day he brings her a little gift, a posy of flowers, a poem, a little lad to dance for her, a kitten. The King and Queen and the Duke travel around the green lanes of Dorset in absolute accord, and whenever the Queen steps down from her litter or turns to go up a stair, the Duke's hand is out to support her, his arm to hold her steady. I had seen him before as a charmer, a seducer, a rogue, but now I see something better in him, a man of great tenderness. He treats her as if he would spare her any fatigue, as if he has dedicated his life to her happiness. He serves the king as a most loyal friend, and he serves her as a knight of chivalry. More than this, I don't want to see. I won't let myself see. In August, we reach Wiltshire, and stay at the old royal palace at Clarendon, in the lush water meadows near Salisbury. I love this chalk meadowland, and the broad, watery valleys. The runs after the deer go on for hours through the woodland of the valley floors, and then we burst out onto the high downland, and gallop across the even-cropped grass. When we halt to eat, we can see half of England spread before us. The palace is set among flowering meads, flooded into lakes for half the year, but a network of clean streams and pools and rivers in this high summer. The Duke takes the Queen fishing, and swears that they will catch a salmon for her dinner, but they spend most of the day with her resting in the shade while he casts a line and gives her the rod to hold, and then casts the line again as the dragonflies dance over the kingcups, and the swallows fly low over the water, skimming their little beaks into their own darting reflections. We come home late in the evening, as the clouds in the sky are like peach and lemon ribbons, swirling above the horizon. It will be another beautiful day tomorrow, the Duke predicts. And the next day? She asks him.
Why not? Why should you not have a beautiful day every day of your life?
She laughs.
You would spoil me.
I would, he says sweetly. I would like you to have a beautiful day every day.
She takes his arm to help her up the stone steps to the great front door of the hunting lodge.
Where is the king? He asks one of the gentlemen of the bedchamber.
In the chapel, your grace, the man replies. With his confessor.
I'll come to your rooms, then, Edmund Beaufort says to the queen.
Shall I sit with you before dinner?
Yes, come, she says.
The ladies arrange themselves on stools and the window seats. The queen and the duke sit in a window embrasure, talking quietly together, their heads close. And then there is a knock, and the doors are thrown open for a messenger from France, who comes hastily in, dirty from the road and with his face grave. Nobody can doubt for a moment that he brings bad news. The duke leaps swiftly to his feet.
Not now, he says sharply. Where is the king?
He has given orders not to be disturbed, the man says. But my orders are to come at all speed and give my message at once, so I've come to you. It's Lord Talbot, God bless him, and Bordeaux.
The duke grabs the man by the arm and marches him out of the door without a word to the queen. She is already on her feet. I go to her side.
Be calm, your grace, I say quickly. You must be calm for the baby.
What's the news? She asks. What's the news from France? Edmund!
A moment, he throws over his shoulders, turning his back on her as if she were an ordinary woman.
Wait a moment.
There is a little gasp of shock from her ladies at how he speaks to her. But I put my arm around her waist and say, Come and lie down, your grace. The Duke will bring you the news when he has it. Come now.
No, she says, pulling away from me. I must know. Edmund, tell me.
For a moment he is in rapid conversation with the messenger. But when he turns, he looks as if someone has struck him in the heart.
It's John Talbot, he says quietly.
I feel the Queen stagger as her knees go weak and she drops down in a faint.
Help me,
I say quickly to one of the ladies in waiting, but it is the Duke who brushes past us all and picks the Queen up into his arms and carries her through her private rooms into her very bedroom and lays her on the bed.
Fetch the physicians,
I snap at one of the ladies and run in after them.
He has half lain her on the bed. He is kneeling on the royal bed. His arms are around her. He is bending over her, holding her like a lover, whispering in her ear.
Margaret, he says urgently. Margaret.
No, I say. Your Grace, Lord Edmund, let her go. I'll take care of her. Leave her.
She holds him by his jacket, her two hands grasping him tightly.
Tell me it all, she whispers desperately to him. Tell me the worst, quickly.
I slam the bedroom door and put my back to it, before anyone can see that he has his hands either side of her face, that she is holding his wrists, that they are scanning each other's eyes.
My love, I can hardly bear to tell you. Lord Talbot is dead. And his son, too. We have lost Castillon, that he was defending. We have lost Bordeaux again. We have lost everything.
She quivers. Dear God, the English will never forgive me. We have lost all of Gascony.
All, he says. And John Talbot himself. God bless his soul.
The tears spill over from her eyes and pour down her cheeks. and Edmund Beaufort drops his head and kisses them away. Kisses her, like a lover trying to comfort his mistress. No! I cry again, utterly horrified. I come to the bed and put my hand on his arm, pulling him away from her. But they are blind and deaf to me, clinging together, her arms around his neck. He is half lying on her, as he covers her face with kisses and whispers promises that he cannot keep. And at that moment, at that terrible, terrible moment, the door behind us opens, and Henry, King of England, comes into the room and sees the two of them wrapped in each other's arms, his pregnant wife and his dearest friend. For a long moment he takes in the scene. Slowly, the Duke lifts his head, and gritting his jaw, gently releases Margaret, laying her back on the bed, pressing her shoulders to make her stay on the pillows, lifting her feet and straightening her gown around her ankles. Slowly, he turns to face her husband. He makes a little gesture with his hands to Henry, but he says nothing. There is nothing he can say. The king looks from his wife, raised on one elbow, white as a ghost on her bed, to the duke standing beside her. And then he looks at me. He looks puzzled, like a hurt child. I reach out to him, as if he were one of my own children, cruelly struck. Don't look, I say foolishly. Don't see. He puts his head on one side, like a whipped dog, as if he's trying to hear me. Don't look, I repeat. Don't see. Strangely, he steps towards me and lowers his pale face to me. Without knowing what I'm doing, I lift my hands to him, and he takes one and then the other and cups my palms over his eyes, as if to blindfold himself. For a moment we are all quite frozen, my hands over his eyes, the Duke waiting to speak, Margaret leaning back on her pillows, her hand over her curving belly. Then the King presses my hands hard against his closed eyelids and repeats my words. Don't look. Don't see. Then he turns away. Without another word, he turns his back on all three of us and walks from the room, quietly closing the door behind him. He does not come to dinner that night. The Queen's dinner is served in her privy rooms. A dozen ladies and I sit down to eat with her and send half the courses back untouched. Edmund, Duke of Somerset, takes the head of the table in the great hall and tells the hushed diners that he has bad news for them. We have lost the last of our lands in France, except for the pale town and garrison of Calais, and that John Talbot, the Earl of Shrewsbury, has died riding out for a forlorn cause that his gallantry and courage would not allow him to refuse. The town of Castillon begged him to come and relieve the French siege, and John Talbot could not turn a deaf ear when his countrymen asked for help. He held to his vow that he would not put on armour against the French king who had released him on that condition. So he rode out, without armour, at the head of our troops, into battle, without a weapon or a shield. It was an act of the most perfect chivalry and folly, an act worthy of the great man that he was. An archer felled his horse, and an axeman hacked him to death as he was pinned down underneath it. Our hopes of holding our lands in France are over. We have lost Gascony for the second and almost certainly the last time. Everything that was won by this king's father has been lost by his son, and we have been humiliated by France that was once our vassal. The Duke bows his head to the silent great hall. We will pray for the soul of John Talbot, and his noble son, Lord Lisle, he says. He was a most gentle,
and perfect knight. And we will pray for the king, for England, and St. George. Nobody cheers. Nobody repeats the prayer. Men say, Amen, Amen, quietly, and pull out their benches, and sit down and eat their dinner in silence. The king goes to bed very early, the gentlemen of his chamber tell me when I go to inquire. They say he seemed very tired. He didn't speak to them. He did not say one word. I tell the queen, and she bites her lip and looks at me, white-faced. "What do you think?" she asks. She seems as frightened as a little maid. I shake my head. I don't know what to think. What should I do? I don't know what she should do. In the morning, the queen is heavy-eyed from a sleepless night. Again, she sends me to the king's rooms to ask how is his grace this morning. Again, the groom of the bedchamber tells me that the king is weary. This morning he is sleeping late. When they told him that it was time for lords, he just nodded and went back to sleep. They are surprised because he never misses chapel. They tried to wake him again for prime, but he did not stir. I go back and tell the queen that he has slept through the morning and is still asleep. She nods and says she will take breakfast in her rooms. In the great hall, the Duke of Somerset breaks his fast with the court. Nobody speaks very much. We are all waiting for more news from France. We are all dreading more news from France. The king sleeps on till midday. Is he ill? I ask the groom of the wardrobe. He never sleeps like this usually, does he?
He was shocked, the groom says. I know that. He came into his rooms as white as a dove, and lay down on the bed without a word to anyone.
He said nothing?
I am ashamed of myself for this question. Nothing. He said not one word.
Send for me as soon as he wakes, I say. The queen is concerned about him.
The man nods, and I go back to the queen's rooms and tell her that the king lay down to sleep and said nothing to anyone.
He said nothing?
She repeats. As I did. Nothing.
He must have seen, she says.
He saw, I say grimly.
Chiquetta, what do you think he will do?
I shake my head. I don't know. All day he sleeps. Every hour I go to the door of the king's rooms and ask if he is woken. Every hour the groom of the chamber comes out, his face more and more worried, and shakes his head. Still sleeping. Then, when the sun is setting, and they are lighting the candles for dinner, the queen sends for Edmund Beaufort.
"I'll see him in my presence chamber," she says, "so that everyone can see we're not meeting in secret. But you stand before us so we can talk privately."
He comes in looking grave and handsome, and kneels before her till she tells him that he can sit. I stand absent-mindedly between them and the rest of the ladies and his entourage, so that nobody can hear their quiet-voiced conversation above the ripple of the harp. They exchange three urgent sentences, and then she rises to her feet, and the court rises too. She grits her teeth, and leads the way into dinner, like the queen she is, to the great hall, where the men greet her in silence, and the king's chair is empty. After dinner, she calls me to her side. "They can't wake him," she says tightly. "The grooms tried to wake him for dinner, but he would not stir. The Duke has sent for the physicians to see if he's sick." I nod. "We'll sit in my rooms," she decides, and leads the way from the hall. As we go out,
there is a whisper like a breeze. Men saying to one another that the king is mortally weary. We wait for them to report in the queen's presence chamber, half the court gathered round, waiting to hear what is wrong with the king. The door opens, and the physicians come in. The queen beckons them to enter her private rooms with the duke, and me, and half a dozen others.
The king seems to be in good health, but he is sleeping, one of the doctors, John Arundel, says.
Can you wake him up?
We judged it best to let him sleep,
Dr. Faceby replies, bowing.
It might be best to let him sleep and wake when he's ready. Grief and a shock will sometimes be healed with a sleep, a long sleep.
A shock? The Duke asks sharply. What shock has the king had? What did he say?
The news from France, the doctor stumbles. I believe the messenger blurted it out.
Yes, he did, I say. The queen fainted, and I took her into her rooms. Margaret nips her lips. Does he speak?
Not a word. Not a word since last night.
She nods as if it is of no matter to her whether he speaks or not. She is concerned only for his health. Very well. Do you think he will wake in the morning?
Oh, most certainly, Dr. Faceby answers. Often someone will sleep deeply after distressing news. It is the body's way to heal itself.
And wake, remembering nothing? She asks. The Duke looks down at the floor, as if indifferent.
You may have to tell him about the loss of Gascony all over again, when he wakes, the doctor agrees.
She turns to the Duke. My lord, please give the king's grooms the order that they should wake him, as usual, in the morning, and prepare his rooms and clothes, as usual. He bows.
Of course, your grace.
The physicians take their leave. One of them will sit in the king's bedroom to watch over his sleep. The duke's entourage and the queen's ladies leave behind the doctors. The couple takes one stolen moment when the duke is at her side and everyone is leaving and no one observing them.
It'll be all right, he whispers. We'll say nothing, nothing. Trust me, it will be all right.
Mutely, she nods, and he bows and goes out of the room. The next day, they go to wake the king, but he does not wake. One of the grooms of the bedchamber comes to the door and tells me that they had to lift the king to the close stool, clean him, and change his nightgown, which he had soiled. If one of them holds him on the close stool, he will pass water, and they can wash his face and hands. They can sit him in a chair, though his head lolls. And if one of them holds his face up, the other can pour a little warm ale down his throat. He cannot stand. He cannot hear them. He doesn't respond to a touch. He shows no hunger, and he would lie in his filth.
This isn't sleep, the groom says bluntly. The doctors are fooling themselves. Nobody sleeps like this.
Do you think he's dying? I ask. The man shakes his head.
I've never seen anything like it in my life before. It's like he's enchanted, like he's cursed.
Don't say such a thing, I reply at once. Never say such a thing. He's just sleeping.
Oh, aye, he repeats. Sleeping, as the doctors say.
I walk slowly back to the Queen's rooms, wishing that Richard were with me, wishing that I was at home in Grafton. I have a terrible fear that I've done something very wrong. I'm filled with fear, superstitious fear, as if I've done something terrible. I wonder if it was my command to the King to see nothing that has blinded him. I wonder if he's the victim of my accidental power. My great-aunt Jehan cautioned me to always be careful what I wished for. to consider very carefully the words of blessings or of curses. And now I have told the King of England, don't look, don't see. And he has closed his eyes, and neither looks nor sees. I shake my head, trying to dispel my own fears. Surely I must have said words like this a dozen times and nothing happened. Why would I have the powers to blind the King of England now? Perhaps he's just very tired. Perhaps he is, as the doctors think, shocked by the news from France. Perhaps he is like one of my mother's aunts, who froze up and lay still, lay quite like the king, neither speaking nor moving, until she died years later. Perhaps I'm frightening myself to think that it was my command that has made him blind. In her rooms, the queen is lying in her bed. I'm so afraid of what I may have done that I recoil on the threshold of her darkened room and whisper, Margaret. She raises her hand. She can move. She's not enchanted. One of her younger ladies is at her side, while the rest of them are in the room outside, whispering about the danger to the baby, and the shock to the queen, and the likelihood of everything going terribly wrong, as women always do when one is near to childbirth. Enough, I say irritably, as I close the door on the queen's chamber so she can't hear these fearful predictions. If you can't say anything cheerful, then don't speak at all. And you, Bessie, I don't want to hear another word about your mother's travails in childbed. I have been brought to bed 11 times, raised 10, and never endured one quarter of the pains you report. Indeed, no woman could have borne what you describe. The queen may well be as lucky as me. I stamp past them to the queen's rooms, and send away my little maid with one wave of my hand. She goes in silence, and for a moment I think the queen is asleep. But she turns her head and looks at me, her eyes dark and hollowed with fatigue and fear. Has the king woken this morning? Her lips are chapped where she's been biting them. She looks haggard with worry. No, I say. Not yet. But they have washed him, and he has taken a little breakfast. He's sitting up? No, I say, uncomfortably. They had to serve him.
Serve him?
Feed him. She is silent.
It's a blessing, in a way, she says. It means he says nothing rashly, in temper, at first thought. It gives us time to consider. I keep thinking that it is a blessing, in a way. It gives us time to prepare.
In a way, I agree.
What do the doctors say?
They say they think he will wake, perhaps tomorrow. And then he will be himself again, and remember everything. Perhaps. I don't believe that they really know.
What shall we do?
I don't know.
She sits on the side of the bed, her hand cupped on her belly, and rises to her feet to look out of the window. Below her are the beautiful gardens running down to the river, where a punt bobs invitingly at a landing stage, and a heron stands still and quiet in the water. She sighs.
Do you have any pain? I ask anxiously.
No, no, I can just feel the baby moving.
It's most important that you remain calm. She laughs shortly.
We have lost Gascony. Next, the French are certain to attack Calais. The king has gone to sleep and cannot be wakened, and...
She breaks off. Neither of us has mentioned the Duke taking her into his arms as an accustomed lover, kissing her face, promising to keep her safe.
And you tell me to remain calm?
I do, I say stoutly. For all this is nothing to losing the child. You have to eat, and you have to sleep, Margaret. This is your duty to the child. You might be carrying a boy. It might be a prince for England. When all this has been forgotten,
We will remember that you kept the prince safe. She pauses. She nods. Yes. Jacquetta, you are right. See? I will sit. I will be calm. You can bring me some bread and some meat and some ale. I will be calm. And fetch the Duke.
You cannot see him alone, I specify.
No, I know that. But I have to see him. Until the king wakes, he and I will have to decide everything together. He is my only adviser and help.
I find the Duke in his rooms, gazing blankly out of the window. He whirls around when his men hammer on the door, and as they throw it open, I see the whiteness of his face and the fear in his eyes. Jacquetta, he says, and then corrects himself. Your Grace. I wait till they have closed the door behind me. The Queen commands your presence, I say shortly. He takes up his cape and his hat.
How is she?
Anxious. He offers me his arm, and childishly I pretend not to see the gesture, but precede him to the door. He follows me out, and we walk down the sunny gallery towards the royal rooms. Outside the leaded windows I can see swallows swooping low over the water meadows, and hear the birds singing. He strides faster to come alongside me.
You blame me, he says shortly.
I don't know anything.
You blame me, but Jacquetta, I assure you, the first move was...
I don't know anything, and if I know nothing, then I cannot be questioned, and I cannot confess, I say, cutting him off. All I want to do is see Her Grace at peace, and strong enough to carry her child to full term and bring him into this world. All I pray is that His Grace the King wakes up with a calm mind, and we can tell him the sad news from Gascony. And I hope, of course, all the time, ceaselessly, that my husband is safe in Calais. Other than these thoughts, I don't venture, Your Grace. He nods his head, and we walk in silence. In the Queen's rooms, I see that the three ladies-in-waiting are sitting in the window seats, pretending to sew while craning their necks to eavesdrop. They rise up and curtsy and make a bustle as the Duke and I enter. I tell them to sit again, and I nod to a couple of musicians to play. This covers the whispers between the Queen and the Duke. She allows him to sit on a stool at her side, and she beckons me to join them. His Grace says that if the king doesn't waken within a few days, we cannot stay here. I look at him.
People will start to wonder, and then there will be gossip. We can say that the king is weary, and he can ride in a litter back to London.
We can draw the curtains of the litter, I agree. But what then?
The queen has to go into her confinement at Westminster Palace. That's been planned for months. It can't be changed. I suggest the king stays quietly in his rooms.
People will talk.
We can say he's praying for her health. We can say he's keeping monastic hours.
I nod. It is possible that the king's illness can be kept from everyone but a small court circle. What about meeting with the lords? What about the king's council? I ask.
I can handle them, the Duke says. I will take decisions in the name of the king.
I look sharply at him, and then I lower my eyes so he cannot see my shock. This is to make himself all but King of England. The queen will be in confinement, the king asleep, and Edmund Beaufort will step up from being Constable of England to King of England. Richard, Duke of York, is likely to object, I remark to the floor beneath my feet.
I can handle him, he says dismissively.
And when the king wakes?
When the king wakes, we will all go back to normal, the queen says. Her voice is strained,
her hand on her belly. "And we will have to explain to him that when he was taken so suddenly ill, we had to decide what to do without consulting him."
"He's likely to be confused when he wakes," the Duke says. "I asked the physicians. They say that he may have troubling dreams, fantasies. He will be surprised at waking. He will not be able to tell what is real and what is a bad dream. Best that it should be in his own bedroom at Westminster, with the country well ruled."
"He may remember nothing," the Queen says. "We may have to tell him again all about the loss of Gascony."
"We must make sure that he hears the news first from us, that we tell him the truth gently," the Duke supplements.
They look like conspirators, their hands close together, whispering. I glance around at the Queen's rooms. No one else seems to see anything out of the ordinary. I realize that I am the only one who suddenly sees a sickening intimacy. The Queen rises to her feet and gives a little moan at a twinge of pain. I see the Duke's hand fly out, and then he checks the gesture. He does not touch her. She pauses and smiles at him. "I'm all right." He glances at me like a young husband prompting a nurse. "Perhaps you should rest, Your Grace," I respond, "if we are to travel to London."
"We will go the day after tomorrow," the Duke rules. "I will order them to get everything ready at once."
Westminster Palace, London, autumn 1453. The rooms for the royal confinement are prepared, according to the traditions of the royal household. The tapestries are taken down, the windows shuttered tight, and hung with thick material to keep out the disturbing light and draughts of air. The fires are banked up. The rooms must be kept warm. Every day the fire boys haul logs up as far as the firmly barred doors. No man, not even the working boys, can come into the Queen's rooms. Fresh rushes are scattered on the floor, especially herbs that are helpful in childbirth, shepherd's purse and motherwort. A low birthing bed is brought into the room and dressed with special sheets. They bring in the royal cradle, an heirloom sent over from Anjou, of beautiful carved wood inlaid with gold. They make it up with the finest linen trimmed with lace. They prepare the swaddling board for the baby. His bands and his cap are all washed and pressed and made ready. An altar is set up in what is usually the privy chamber, and a screen placed between the bedroom and the chamber, so the priest can come in and serve the mass and the queen observe him without being seen. She will make her confession from behind a veiled screen. Not even an ordained priest can come into these rooms for 6 weeks before the birth and for 6 weeks after. In practice, in most households, a loving husband will break the rules and come in to see his wife during her confinement, as soon as the baby is born, washed, swaddled, and laid in the cradle. Many husbands will not touch her until she's been churched, believing that she is unclean after the travail of childbed, and might contaminate him with female sin. But a husband like Richard disregards such fears as superstitions. He is always tender and affectionate and loving at these times, and brings me fruit and sweetmeats that the older women say are not allowed, and has to be chased from the room by the midwives who protest that he will disturb me, or wake the baby, or make work for them. No man will come near the poor little queen, of course. No man is allowed in the royal confinement chamber, and her husband, the only one who might trespass, is in his own shadowy room, washed daily, as if he were a big overgrown baby, fed as if he were in his dotage, limp as a new corpse. We are holding the terrible news of the king's health tightly within the walls of the palace. The grooms of his chamber know, but they are so appalled at the work they have to do, and the collapse of the man they knew, that it has not been hard for Edmund Beaufort to take each one aside
swear him to secrecy, and threaten him with the most terrible punishments if he so much as whispers a word outside the walls. The king's household, his companions and his grooms, his page boys, his master of horse and the grooms in the stable, know only that the king is stricken with an illness that makes him very tired and very weak, incapable of riding. They wonder what can be wrong with him, but they are not troubled very much. It's not as if he was ever a lusty man who called for 4 hunters in the morning and would ride one after another as each foundered. The quiet life of the king's stables remains quiet, and only the men who see him inert in his bed, in his peaceful bedroom, realize how gravely ill the king has become. We are helped in our rule of silence by the fact that most of the lords and gentry have left London for the summer and are slow to return. The Duke doesn't summon Parliament, so the country gentry have no reason to come into the city, and everything that has to be decided in the kingdom is done with a handful of men in the king's council, in the name of the king, but under the signature of the Duke. He tells them that the king is unwell, too fatigued to come to council, and he, Edmund Beaufort, as his most trusted kinsman, will hold the king's seal and use it to ratify any decision. Almost no one suspects that the king is quite incapable of coming to the council. Most of them think he is in his private chapel, praying for the health of the queen, studying in silence, and that he has given the seal and the authority to Edmund Beaufort, who has always commanded so much anyway. But the rumours start, as they are bound to do. The cooks remark that they never send good joints of meat into the king's rooms, but only soups. And then some fool of a groom says that the king cannot chew his food, and then hushes himself and says, "God save him," and takes himself off. Of course, the physicians come and go in and out of the king's rooms, and anyone seeing them is bound to notice that they are strange doctors and physicians, herbalists and practitioners of all sorts, coming at the bidding of the Duke and going into the king's rooms. The physicians would not dare to speak, but they are attended by servants and have messengers bringing them herbs and physic. After a week of this, the Duke invites me to his rooms and asks me to tell the Queen that it is his advice that the king be taken to Windsor, where they can more easily nurse him, without the news getting out. She won't like it, I tell him frankly. She won't like him being kept there and her trapped here in confinement. "If he stays here, the people will start to talk," he says. "We can't keep it secret, and she will want to avoid gossip more than anything else." I curtsy and go to the door. "What do you think?" he asks as my hand is on the latch. "What do you think, Your Grace? You're a woman of gifts. What do you think will become of the king? And what of the queen, if he never recovers?" I say nothing. I am too old a hand at court to be led into speculation about the future of a king by the man who is standing in his shoes. "You must have thoughts," he says impatiently. "I may have thoughts, but I have no words," I say, and leave him. But that night, I dream of the Fisher King of the legend, a country commanded by a king too frail and too weak to do anything but go fishing, while a young woman has to rule the land alone and longs for a man who can stand at her side. The Queen finds her confinement tedious, and the daily reports from Windsor Castle make the days only worse. They are torturing the King with one remedy after another. The reports speak of draining him of cool fluids and heating of his vital parts, and I know that they mean cupping him to draw off his blood and then burning him where he lies, silent as a crucified Christ, waiting to rise again. Some nights I get up from the little bed that I have in the Queen's room and pull up the corner of the tapestry over the window so that I can see the moon, a big, warm harvest moon, so near to earth that I can see every wrinkle and pockmark on her face,
and I ask her, did I bewitch the king? Did I ill-wish him? In that moment of fright when I bade him see nothing, did I, in truth, make him blind? Could such a thing be? Could I be so powerful? And if it was me, how can I take the words back and restore him? I feel very alone with this worry. Of course I cannot share it with the Queen, who has her own guilt and fear. I dare write nothing to Richard. Such thoughts should not be in my mind, never on paper. I am sick and tired of being trapped in these shadowy rooms. The Queen's confinement is long and anxious for us all. This should be the happiest autumn of her life, with a baby on the way at last. But instead, we are all filled with fear about the King. And now some of the ladies are whispering that the baby will be born asleep too. When I hear this, I go down to the river and sit on the pier as the sun is setting and look over the swiftly moving water that flows towards the sea, and I whisper to Melusina that if I ever said a word that wished the king blinded, I take back that word now. If I ever had a thought that he should see nothing, then I deny that thought now, and I wish with all my heart that the baby born to the queen will be well and healthy and live long and happy. I go slowly back to the palace, not knowing if the river has heard my wishes, or if the river can do anything anyway, or if the moon can understand how desolate a mere woman can feel, far from her husband, and in a world that is filled with danger. I walk in to a hushed bustle.
Her waters have broken,
a maid hisses, running past me with some clean linen. I hurry into the bedroom. The midwives are here already. The rockers are making up the cradle with clean sheets and the softest blanket. The mistress of the bedchamber is heating a poker to mull the special birthing ale. And the queen herself is standing at the foot of the best bed, bent over, holding the bedpost, sweat on her white face, gripping her lower lip in her teeth. I go straight to her. The pain passes, I say. Moment by moment, it comes and it goes away again. You have to be brave.
I am brave, she says furiously. No one shall ever say otherwise.
I see the irritability of childbirth, and I take a damp cloth soaked in lavender water and gently wipe her face. She sighs as the pain recedes, and then braces herself for the next wave. It takes a long time to come. I glance at the midwife.
Going to take a while, she says wisely. We'd all better have a mug of ale and a sit-down.
It does take a while, all night. But next day, on the day of St. Edward, she gives birth to a boy. A precious Lancaster boy. And the safety and the inheritance of England is assured. I go outside to the presence chamber, and there are the lords of England, waiting for news. Edmund Beaufort is among them, not standing forwards as he usually does, commanding the room, but away from the bedchamber door, a little aside, making himself one of the crowd. For once in his life he is not claiming pride of place, and this makes me hesitate, not knowing if I should go directly and tell him. He is the Constable of England. He is the most favoured lord in the land. He commands the Privy Council, and they are his nominated men in Parliament. He is the favourite of King and Queen, and we are all accustomed to giving way to him. I would normally speak to him before any other. Of course, the first man to have the news should be the baby's father, the King, but he, God bless him, is far, far away. There is no protocol for today, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I hesitate for a moment, and then as all the talk dies down, and the men turn to look at me in expectant silence, I say simply, "My lords, I give you joy. The Queen has been brought to bed of a handsome boy, and has named him Edward. God save the King."
A few days later, as the baby thrives and the Queen rests, I'm coming back to the Queen's chambers after a walk in the garden.